This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome, listeners, to the Christian Science Monitor News for Monday, June 8, 2026. I'm Mark Stengel for Mind's Eye, translating vision into audio. Today's first article is a Christian Science perspective from Cynthia Cowan. It's entitled, Immortality Now? Yes. Are you immortal now? People generally believe that immortality comes after death, but Christian Science shows us we can experience immortality here and now. The biblical account of Enoch says he walked with God and lived 365 years before he was translated that he should not see death, and was not found because God had translated him. For before his translation, he had this testimony that he pleased God. Walking with God means obeying, trusting, and communing with God, who is love divine. Clearly, Enoch, who pleased God throughout his life, continued walking with him spiritually following his translation, his disappearance to human sense, and removal to heaven without being subject to death. Christ Jesus constantly walked with God. His understanding of being one with his Father enabled him to perceive man as the reflection of God, immutable and immortal. When multitudes of six people came to him, Jesus' clear perception of man as God's image and likeness healed them. In the Bible, there's an account of Jesus communing with God and speaking with Elias and Moses, both of whom had lived centuries before him. How is it that these men were present? Man, the reflection of God, divine principle, exists without a beginning or an end. Jesus demonstrated this. While these examples are some of the very highest of evidencing immortality here and now, step by step we too can glimpse immortality. As we relinquish timelines of birth and death and views of man as separated from God, we will increasingly see ourselves and others as evidence of God's expression of himself, spiritual, whole, and immortal. Often this takes persistence, courage, and a pure desire to walk with God. As the birth of our second child neared, my husband and I were informed by the doctors that my life and my child's would be in danger if I did not have an operation and blood transfusion. They also feared that even if we went through with these procedures, it might already be too late to prevent my child from being brain damaged. Based on what I understood of God and of myself and my child made in God's image and likeness, I knew this assessment was not the final word, and I didn't go through with the procedures. During the entire pregnancy, I had endeavored to walk with God, to really understand my child's and my present immortality. Now was the time to fully trust God as the divine principle in life. During the next 2 days, as a Christian Science practitioner and our family prayed with us, my husband and I gained a clear sense that all was well, and it was. The baby was born easily. There were no complications, and both of us were and remained healthy. As we more consistently walk with God, listening, trusting, and expecting all good, we can experience more of the immortality that is truly ours, now and always. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, June 8, 2026, comes from Stephanie Haynes. She is the print editor of the Christian Science Monitor. Her article is entitled, At the Beginning of Route 66, Reporting on a Shifting United States. Reporter Harry Brunius found a crossroads of America in the middle of Will County, Illinois, southwest of Chicago. Not far from the legendary Route 66, Harry saw waving grasslands and bison-dotted vistas alongside a jumble of railroad tracks and cities of shipping containers. It is a place, he reports in this week's magazine, of contrasts and transformation, progress and disruption, of debates about what it is to be American and what is worth protecting, changing, or expanding. The story of Will County and of what it is experiencing as an army of trucks moves an ever-expanding supply of goods across the country is fascinating, and it is exactly the sort of piece we had hoped Harry would find as he set out to travel the entirety of Route 66, which turns 100 years old this year. When we first discussed Harry's idea to find stories along the celebrated roadway, he and I both recently changed positions at the Monitor. For almost 2 years, Harry was my editor, working with me on many of the stories that appeared on the cover of this magazine. Now he was setting out to be our roving Heartland correspondent. I was the new editor responsible for this magazine, and my job was to help Harry and his editor, Scott Blanchard, figure out what sorts of stories Harry might look for, how we would package his reporting, and how all of this could fit into the Monitor's mission to give our readers the sort of news that expands one's understanding of the world. I didn't have to do much. Harry and Scott embody one of our five guiding principles for putting the Monitor's mission into practice, to investigate ideals and endeavors, not just events. And Harry's story this week, the second of many we plan to include in these pages from along Route 66, epitomizes that Monitor approach to news and storytelling. Other stories in our magazine this week show similar insight. Simon Montlake reports on the American superfans who are hoping one day, at least, to give United States soccer a home field advantage. Howard LaFranchi writes about the way Ukraine's expertise in drones, hard-earned from more than 4 years of battling Russia, has turned the country from one begging for aid into a sought-after military expert. Story Hinckley writes about the complications of communicating climate science and how even good news can be misinterpreted. And don't miss Cameron Pugh's piece about the Gen Z delight for crossword puzzles. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, June 8, 2026, is entitled, How America's Buy Now Economy is Altering Its Heartland. And this article is written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Harry Brunius. On certain evenings in Will County, Illinois, from the raised overpasses that cross its highways, a contrast becomes apparent. Freight trains inch past long gray grass prairie in long metallic lines. Semi-trucks stream through newly widened intersections and closed-loop designated routes. And beyond them, bison brought back to the region a decade ago graze quietly on protected land, land that once produced explosives for three American wars. Old U.S. Route 66, too, passes right through it. Along this stretch of the road, two very different parts of America exist side by side. One is the remnant of what Cyrus Avery imagined a century ago, when he first proposed Route 66 as the main street of America, local, optimistic, built around the freedom of the open road and the vast landscapes it crossed. The vision was to connect thousands of local businesses and far-flung communities in a national marketplace. The other side is a logistics system of astonishing speed and precision, and it is central to the current geography of American commerce. Here, that same vision of a connected national marketplace has become less a destination than a continental-scale conveyor belt beneath an American way of life. Center Point Intermodal Center sits at the center of this logistics system in a corridor just southwest of Chicago. It receives imported goods from West Coast ports and then delivers them into the American heartland. In just 20 years, Center Point has become the central node of the American retail economy. More than 3 million shipping containers pass through the facility every year, carrying an estimated $100 billion in goods before being fanned out in every direction to storefronts and family front doors across the Midwest and beyond. It is served by two Class 1 railroads and two interstate highways. It has 10 square miles of land holding a latticework of rail spurs, regimented stacks of intermodal containers, and rows of wide-span gantry cranes. There are millions of square feet of warehouse space and thousands of big rigs moving goods around the clock. You are in the heartbeat of the country here, says Adam Roth, a longtime leasing agent for CenterPoint and executive vice president of NAI Hiffman, a commercial real estate firm. Logistics hubs do not draw the public fascination of artificial intelligence or futuristic robotics, or even the nostalgia that surrounds Route 66. But CenterPoint and hubs like it reveal something equally important about the country Americans have built for themselves. Here, fresh fruit arrives year-round from thousands of miles away, press a digital buy now button, and online orders appear at front doors within a day, sometimes hours. A product unloaded from a container ship in Los Angeles can be sitting on a store shelf in Ohio before the week is out. My dad said to me, "It's really interesting that we eat better than the Pharaohs did," Mr. Ross said, "because they ate whatever was in season, whatever they could get their hands on. Whereas we can go and get almost anything, even more, any time of the year." But such abundance also brings an American dilemma, at least on the Main Street level of the country. Centerpoint has already established itself as the largest inland port in North America. Now another developer, Northpoint, has plans to nearly double the warehouse capacity of the region, and thus the number of trucks. This land the proposal covers is mostly farmland, including small rural towns that also serve as quiet bedroom communities for professionals throughout the Chicago metropolitan area. There are conflicts, competing visions clashing, and the stakes are high. As America's logistics machine keeps expanding, the benefits include lower costs and greater convenience for United States consumers. That expansion might be progress, another stage in Avery's original vision of a grand national marketplace. That progress, however, can be measured against the disruption of the daily lives of the people who live here, some of them in a small town just a few miles down the road. On a sunny Friday afternoon in May, John Keekin and his brother-in-law, Ron Adamski, are driving down a historic stretch of Route 66, now Illinois Route 53, pointing out the new North Point warehouses that line parts of the road. Both men have been fighting the developers' planned expansion, which, according to current proposals, would impinge upon their homes in Manhattan, Illinois, less than 10 miles away. A quiet community, great people. They take care of each other, always willing to help out, says Mr. Adamski, a Gulf War veteran who served on the aircraft carrier USS America and a retired air traffic controller. "It's that type of community, and we're getting swallowed up by outside forces." North Point is seeking to acquire some 4,000 acres, or about 6 square miles of farmland and other residential areas, and expand the existing landscape of warehouses and truck routes into parts of their small rural town. Not everyone in the surrounding communities is against the plan. Some who agreed to sell their land saw deals fall apart after Mr. Adamski and Mr. Keekin brought legal challenges. They weren't happy with them, the men say. Mr. Keekin has lived in Manhattan for nearly 40 years. In the 1980s, he was an electrical engineer at Inland Steel in East Chicago, Indiana. "The 40-mile commute was brutal," he says. "But he came home to the prairie every night because the prairie was the point. Go outside day or night, and all you hear are the sounds of either farming or nature," he says from the back seat during the drive. "You don't hear the trucks. You don't hear the sounds of a city. And this is going to change all that." He has already been a part of a major transformation of American industry. Inland was bought out in 1998 as the United States steel industry waned. Mr. Keekin switched careers, teaching himself web design at a crucial moment of social and economic change, and founding Midwestern Industries, a tech company he still runs today, without a commute. Mr. Adamski arrived just 7 years ago, seeking the quietude of rural life and buying a house in a new subdivision of modest homes. It has become something of a bedroom community, the town being the southern terminus of a commuter railway connected to Chicago's Union Station. "You should have more say when someone wants to put a monstrosity right at the edge of your boundaries," he says, gesturing at the hundreds of acres of farmland on Cherry Hill Road, not far from where he lives. In 2020, the two men co-founded the grassroots organization Stop North Point, and today they are part of an ongoing quality of life lawsuit against the developer. It coalesced after Mr. Adamski won a seat on the village board, part of a wave election that replaced supporters of an economic development and brought in leaders broadly sympathetic to the anti-warehouse cause. 3 years after Mr. Adamski's election, the Manhattan Village Board voted 6-0 to formally join the Stop North Point lawsuit against the developer and the city of Joliet. Mr. Adamski, whose name is on the lawsuit, abstained from the vote, seeing a conflict of interest as a public official. He had given the movement its foothold in village government. Now, in a final act of civic scruple, he stepped aside and let the village carry it forward on its own. Large forces of history have converged in Will County before. Decades ago, Centerpoint's land was occupied by the Joliet Army Ammunition Plant, which opened in 1940. To build it, the U.S. government displaced those living on 450 family farms, most through negotiated purchases, but others through eminent domain. At its peak, the Joliet Arsenal employed more than 10,000 people and produced more TNT than any facility in the world. It made the majority of American munitions for World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War. Most work at the arsenal stopped in 1976, the nation's bicentennial, and it was later abandoned and declared a Superfund site. In 1996, Congress subdivided the land. Almost 20,000 acres were used to create the Midwind National Tall Grass Prairie, a nature preserve, to bring back the original landscape before the farms came. Bison were brought here in 2015. Another 1,000 acres were used to create the Abraham Lincoln National Cemetery, now the second largest military cemetery by acreage in the country. The transformation of the toxic site included granting CenterPoint about 2,000 acres of land as part of a wider arrangement with federal, state, and local officials to clean it up. The company also received at least $150 million in public tax financing, along with agreements that local authorities would provide necessary infrastructure. Its proposal to the small town of Elwood in the early 2000s promised an economic boom. The pitch included an estimated 12,000 well-paying new jobs. Elwood was enthusiastic, and it gave the developer 20 years without having to pay property taxes. By 2013, however, Elwood sued the center. It claimed the project had produced only about 3,800 jobs, most of them low-wage warehouse work, and brought in less than half the projected tax revenue from economic activity. Instead, the lawsuit said, truck traffic and road maintenance had overwhelmed the village. On top of that, the town was $30 million in debt from costs of providing infrastructure. That lawsuit marked an important turning point. Elwood shifted from an enthusiastic partner to an increasingly vocal critic of the logistics hub it had helped build. The city of Joliet also had legal disputes with the developer over the years. But in June 2025, the city council unanimously approved a settlement resolving years of regional litigation. Under the settlement, truck traffic must now flow through a closed-loop road network designed to keep semis off residential streets, a major concession to community opponents. Critically for taxpayers, the city shed what attorneys estimate as hundreds of millions of dollars in road and bridge maintenance liability. But that's nearly 10 miles from Manhattan, through which more and more trucks are already starting to pass. Many carry the intermodal containers that have dramatically changed how quickly a shirt or a TV or a bunch of bananas can arrive at a neighborhood supercenter or be left on a front porch. For most of the nation's history, the great choke points of commerce sat at the water's edge. Baltimore, New Orleans, New York, Los Angeles. Then came the intermodal container, the standard-sized steel box that crosses oceans on a ship, transfers to a rail car without being unloaded, and then arrives by truck at a warehouse. That single invention made a second generation of ports possible far from any ocean. BNSF Railway joined CenterPoint to launch the new intermodal center in 2002. Walmart was among the first large retailers to see its efficiencies in 2006, and it now occupies 3.5 million square feet of space. Union Pacific Railroad connected its spurs to the facility in 2010, and Amazon came in 2015. The center now has 4 million square feet. Dozens more retailers and third-party shippers have arrived during the past decade. People say Walmart is really a logistics company disguised as a retailer. That's how important logistics is now, says Mr. Roth, the leasing agent who was instrumental in bringing the nation's largest retailer to the complex. It used to be, "Oh yeah, this is the person that books trucks," Mr. Roth says. Now it's about the rise of the chief supply chain officer as one of the most important executives in any retail company. During a drive through the complex, as Mr. Roth explains the site's history and current occupants, his phone rings often. CenterPoint still has hundreds of acres on site to develop, and he's working on another deal. After driving through parts of Joliet and Elwood, Mr. Keekun and Mr. Adamski head back to their hometown of Manhattan. They note the truck traffic. At least two or three semis pass through every minute or so. At one intersection on State Street, they point out a corner where a 15-year-old boy was struck and killed by a truck. That stop sign was the result of that accident, Mr. Adamski says. About 20,000 trucks pass through neighboring Joliet every day, according to a recent analysis. While many use the interstates and direct routes to the intermodal center or surrounding warehouses, about 6,000 per day use local routes and highways, passing through communities such as Manhattan. Mr. Adamski recalls incidents in which truck drivers, disoriented by the maze of access roads, were regularly turning into the Abraham Lincoln National Cemetery by mistake, and in at least one case, driving over graves. That gets you fired up if you're a veteran, he says. As a result of the accidental truck traffic, the cemetery built a roundabout so they could safely turn back to the road. Joliet's legal settlement has frustrated the two men, but they got a recent boost. After much of the Stop North Point lawsuit was tossed, an appellate court reinstated its quality of life claims. Mr. Keekin sacrificed to make Manhattan his home. After four decades living here, he'll fight to the end, he says. We go to Midwin National Tallgrass Prairie all the time, Mr. Adamski says. I'm a veteran, and so I'm connected to Abraham Lincoln National Cemetery. There's just beautiful places here where we live. We want to keep them. Center Point and the logistics corridor it anchors is not an ugly place. Most of the warehouses here are less than 15 years old. Trains enter slowly, surrounded by restored prairie. It is massive, but it is not loud. We have people over the years come and tour, and they're expecting it to be more of a beehive, and it's kind of not, says Mr. Roth. For generations, Americans have repeatedly remade the landscape in pursuit of new forms of prosperity and connection. Canals, railroads, highways, factories, suburbs, logistics hubs. Each transformation brought growth and disruption at once, creating wealth and mobility while reshaping the lives of the people who happened to live where the next system needed to go. And it's true. Trucks are essential in this logistics system that has risen up to serve the demands of the new digital economy. In any development, especially anything of this magnitude, you're going to have proponents and you're going to get people that aren't in favor of it, Mr. Ross says. Some people are going to look at the larger economy. It's really a matter of your perspective and what benefits that person. West Laraway Road connects Center Point to the intersection of Old Route 66, about a mile from the site. On a late Friday afternoon in May, a line of semi-trucks and other vehicles stretches for hundreds of yards, driven by the ceaseless demand of a new American economy. Your Christian Science Monitor news for Monday, June 8, 2026, continues with this article. It's entitled, Boots on the Ground, World Cup's American Moment. Star-spangled superfans hope their raucous support might give U.S. soccer a home field advantage. Eagle Man poses for selfies. And this story is written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Simon Montlake. Marcus Cranston is a retired United States Air Force doctor who lives in Las Vegas. In United States soccer circles, he goes by another name, Eagle Man. As a recent tailgate ahead of United States men's national team game, he arrives wearing his trademark American Eagle outfit, Fans flock to take selfies with him and his wife, Lila, who is dressed as Wonder Woman. But they're not the only superfans dressed to impress. There's Uncle Sam in his striped pants, and hundreds of fans are clad in red, white, and blue. Their stars and stripes bandanas are both practical accessories for the sunny afternoon in Atlanta, and a shout-out to the organizers of the gathering, the American Outlaws. The soccer supporters group has 25,000 paid members in more than 200 chapters. Started in 2007 by two college students in Nebraska, its Wild West name still references the defiance central to being an American soccer superfan. We're trying all we can to take over a little piece of the soccer fandom in the world, so we're a little bit outlaws, says Mr. Cranston. Indeed, Eagle Man and his comrades are rebels standing against the United States sports establishment. They're also taking on the giants of world soccer and their supporter armies. And with the FIFA World Cup starting June 11, jointly hosted by the United States, Canada and Mexico, they are fighting to do what many in the game believe is impossible, give the United States team a crowd-fueled home field advantage. Lords of the Pitch. Held every 4 years, the month-long World Cup tournament is the most watched sporting event in the world. This is the first time since 1994 that a United States team will play a World Cup on home soil. But in a nation of immigrants, many from countries where soccer, better known as football, is a way of life, the United States national team can't always count on home field support. Luis Ibarra, a police officer and American Outlaws member from Amarillo, Texas, traveled to Houston last summer to watch the United States take on Mexico in a Gold Cup final. Mexico won the game 2-1. It was probably only our section in the whole stadium going for the United States, says Mr. Ibarra, which is usually like that in most games, to be honest. That isn't going to stop Eagle Man from trying. He joins a circle for warm-up chants for the upcoming match against Portugal. At the center is Phil Labas, a bald, hulking outlaw from Chicago, who is one of tonight's capos. Mr. Labas passes out cards with printed lyrics. "This is a new one," he bellows. The group lines up for an all-singing, all-dancing parade to the stadium gates, where they pause on a partly paved bridge. "Jump for the USA! Jump for the USA! Olé, olé!" And they jump. 300 soccer fans pogo in unison, and the bridge somewhat alarmingly vibrates with them. In a sports-saturated country that valorizes success, the USMNT faces a chicken-or-egg quandary. It needs all the superfans it can muster to cheer its players on to victory. But first, it would help to win big games to convert more casual fans into soccer superfans. "We need the people," says Mauricio Pannacino, an Argentinian coach hired in 2024 to lead the USMNT, or the United States men's national team, into the World Cup. "We need the fans. The fans have 1 year to realize how important are the fans in soccer." Roar of the underdogs. The last time the United States hosted the World Cup in 1994, soccer had a tenuous foothold outside of immigrant communities. The United States had no professional league, and aficionados who wanted to follow leagues in other countries couldn't watch live games. When United States sports channels showed soccer clips, it was usually to get a rise out of the antics of players. But Major League Soccer has grown from 10 teams in 1996 to 30 teams, which mostly play in dedicated soccer stadiums. A generation of Americans have grown up watching international games on streaming platforms. Youth soccer has boomed around the country and has led growing interest in college and club games. While soccer ranks fourth behind football, basketball, and baseball as a spectator sport in the United States, its audience skews young. 38% of adults ages 25 to 34 are interested in soccer, compared with 14% of people over age 55. The last World Cup final in 2022, in which Argentina, led by Lionel Messi, lifted the trophy, was the most watched soccer game ever in the United States, with nearly 27 million viewers. Mr. Messi now plays for Inter Miami, a top MLS club. This year's World Cup expanded the format from 32 to 48 teams that play in a group stage, from which the top teams proceed to a series of playoffs. The final will be played July 19 at the MetLife Stadium in New Jersey. Only the most starry-eyed boosters expect the U.S. MNT to make it to that final. Being a fan of the United States men's soccer means rooting for the underdog and not mining defeats. For the United States women's national team, the opposite is true. It has won 4 World Cups, most recently in 2019. When American sports fans asked Travis Thomas, the United States men's national team leadership and team dynamics coach at the last World Cup, how long before the men's team lifts the trophy, assuming that it's just a matter of time, he replies, maybe never. He points out that only 8 countries have won the World Cup since it was first held in 1930. That isn't what they expect to hear, he says. The American bravado is that we should be good at everything. Mr. Thomas no longer works for the team, but still coaches individual players. He says Mr. Panichino, the American team coach, is right to urge fans to show up. Home team advantage is always giving you that extra boost. I don't think you're going to run into a player that tries to say it doesn't give him a boost. Chris Reed, who runs the Outlaws chapter in Boston, still remembers watching the U.S. MNT play Poland in Chicago. It was probably 80% Poland supporters, he says. When the U.S. played South Korea last year in Harrison, New Jersey, the stadium was a sea of South Korean fans in face paint singing K-pop-derived chants. Millions of visiting fans are expected at the World Cup. The fervor and intensity with Mr. Pochettino, the United States men's national team manager, so envies, is what hooked Mr. Reed, who's attended 53 U.S. national games, including in Mexico and El Salvador. It's the atmosphere, the passion of the fans, the passion they create in the stadium, he says. Waivers of the red, white, and blue. Elliot Maltovan grew up watching soccer with his Ecuador-born father. During the World Cup, he saw his neighbors in New York pull on jerseys from Brazil and Mexico and cheer for their teams at bars and restaurants. Today, he's a diehard United States soccer fan, something his late father came to appreciate. He told me, "I came to this country to give my kids a better opportunity. Don't be afraid to wear the U.S. jersey," said Mr. Montalvan. He remembers watching a televised game between the United States and Ecuador with his father, who wore his Ecuadorian jersey while Mr. Montalvan wore his U.S. MNT jersey. Before the game, the two took turns to separately stand and sing the national anthems. "That was my father's generation. You're going to follow the country you came from," he says. Mr. Montalvan joined an American Outlaws chapter and watched games with other members, but it didn't gel with the soccer milieu he was raised in. When he heard about Barra 76, a new U.S. supporters group set up by Spanish-speaking Latinos, he wanted in. Barra 76 is much smaller than the Outlaws. Both are recognized as official supporter groups by U.S. Soccer, though allowing members to buy discounted tickets and bring their banners into stadiums. Barra 76 doesn't attend every U.S. MNT game, but when the group does, it brings us culture and intensity, says Mr. Montalvan, a paramedic who has his chapter in New York City. He adds, "I'm never afraid to step to people and say, this is Ecuador, is where I came from. I'm here supporting the USA, but we're all diverse here." The Outlaws were not the first fan group. Before them, there was Sam's Army, a group started in 1995 by a high schooler teacher from Buffalo, New York. Back then, soccer was even more of an oddity, says John Sousa, a teacher and soccer coach from Massachusetts. He used to mail scarves to members to bring to games so they could recognize each other. Sam's Army was a way for fans to get together and party, he chuckles. Since then, the torch has passed to the American Outlaws. It costs $30 a year to join, which includes a T-shirt. Different chapters tweak the logo with a local icon, a peach for Atlanta, a bridge for Jacksonville, Florida. In Atlanta, where the United States was playing Portugal in a doubleheader just days after a match against Belgium, fans from at least 50 chapters turned out to cheer. These fans don't always get much respect from their rivals in historic soccer nations who dismiss American fandom as cosplay. To earn respect, they're dialing up the sort of raucous soccer partisanship that gets credibility in this world. I don't want to go into a game where they look at us and say, "Oh, how cute," says Mr. Montalvan. Hopefully, they'll start to see that we mean business. That even means putting a stake in the sports American name. During the 2022 World Cup, when the United States played England, the American Outlaws hung banners that read, "Call it soccer." I wanted at least one goal. At the Portugal game, the United States supporters section is packed and loud. A row of six drums the size of tractor tires halfway up keeps the beat going for the chants, and most fans are on their feet for the entire game. Other sections of the stadium, which holds nearly 73,000 attendees, are a sea of red Portugal jerseys, mostly those of superstar striker Cristiano Ronaldo. Families of Portuguese descent have traveled to Atlanta from across the country for the game. In the first half, the USMNT goes toe-to-toe with Portugal, but it's the visitors who score first. A lightning-fast strike on the goal before the United States supporters. Cheers erupt around the stadium. In the second half, Portugal dominates and scores a second goal, and this time the whooping is much louder. The game ends 2-0 to Portugal. It is the second defeat of the doubleheader after Belgium won 5-2. Both Belgium and Portugal are favored to do well at the World Cup, and the United States might encounter them in the playoffs. But the scoreline doesn't seem to faze the Outlaws, who keep cheering until the end. Mr. Labas, the capo, has missed most of the game because he faces away from the field. Mr. Ibarra and his two friends from Amarillo, Texas, who drove 18 hours to Atlanta, are still on their feet, American flags wrapped around their shoulders. Eagle Man sits a few rows away, catching his breath. "It was a fun time," says Jenna Pepmiller, one of the Atlanta Outlaws. "There's so many people showing up on a Tuesday night." But she adds, "I wanted more. I wanted at least one goal." Mr. Sousa no longer follows the United States team around. Now retired, he lives in Tampa. But he flew to Atlanta to watch the game in the Portugal section. His family immigrated in 1966 from the Azores, he explains. He still roots for the U.S. team when it's not playing Portugal, and even made a banner for the game that combines both teams' flags. Mr. Sousa was delighted to see roving supporters cheering on the USMNT as he once did in Sam's Army. He also traveled to Brazil and Argentina to watch their home games, and the intensity of the crowds and their identification with those teams has stayed with him. Those fans aren't casual sports watchers. They're soccer diehards, and nothing else counts. "We can't match that. We never will, because that's all they've got," he says. Your Christian Science Monitor News continues for Monday, June 8, 2026, with this following article. Iran war opened doors for drone-savvy Ukraine. Zelensky is seizing the moment. For years, Ukraine's leader begged foreign governments for help. Now they buy drones from him, showing that Kyiv has become a valued partner. And this article is written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Howard LaFranchi. In Persian Gulf and Middle Eastern capitals from Riyadh to Damascus, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has recently found the red carpet rolled out for him. He has also been warmly received by European leaders from Berlin to Ankara, courted as a valued partner. What a contrast was the scene that played out in the Oval Office in February 2025 when U.S. President Donald Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance belittled Mr. Zelensky as a tiresome ingrate and even denied him the luncheon that had been on the agenda. In just 1 year, Ukraine has been transformed from a supplicant nation pleading for international support for its survival to a hot ticket on the international relations circuit. What's changed can be summarized in two words: drone diplomacy. Ukraine had already understood that in a world of mounting conflict and great power competition, the battlefield innovations it has deployed and honed since Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022, drones chief among them, would solicit widespread interest. But efforts to leverage that drone technological know-how into stronger international standing advanced slowly, until this year. In February, a watershed moment occurred when the United States and Israel attacked Iran, as Iran started to wreak havoc on its Persian Gulf neighbors, deploying the same Shahed drones Russia uses in Ukraine. Interest surged in Ukraine's battle-tested drone technology, now widely considered the global standard. It wasn't long before Gulf states decided they needed to know more about the cheap but effective interceptor drones Ukraine has developed to counter the Iranian-designed Shahids. Important transition. Ukraine's drone diplomacy was born, creating for Kyiv not only the opportunity for lucrative exports, but also joint development projects and bilateral bridge building. This is a very important transition for Ukraine, from recipient of international help to provider of desirable expertise in defense technologies and infrastructure, says Volodymyr Fisenko, director of the Penta Center for Political Studies in Kyiv. If we see Zelensky talking about this all the time and pursuing his drone diplomacy wherever he goes, he adds, it's because he understands how this strengthens Ukraine's position. The Ukrainian leader has been trying for years to shift his country's image from one of needy assistance recipient to more of an equal partner, certainly in Europe, but elsewhere as well. His initial efforts to expand relations with Middle Eastern countries were a disappointment, diplomatic experts say, because Ukraine was seen as having little to offer other than the grains it has traditionally exported to help feed the region. Ukraine had tried for many years to demonstrate in different ways that we could be a security provider and a valuable defense partner, but for many countries, in NATO definitely, it was always what we can provide you Ukrainians, says Hannah Schillist, Director of Security Studies and Global Outreach at the Ukrainian PRISM Foreign Policy Council. There was little interest in Ukraine's desire for partnerships and two-way goals. Then came war in the Persian Gulf. It's not only that this war triggered relationships with countries in the Middle East that Zelensky had been trying to cultivate, Mr. Fisenko says, but when these countries found out they were not prepared to respond to Iran's drone attacks, and when the whole world witnessed this, it opened a window of opportunity for Ukraine. The defense technology Ukraine was offering was not only superior, but also cheaper, as Iran sent waves of relatively inexpensive drones slamming into Gulf military installations, swanky hotels, and vital oil and gas facilities. The Gulf countries responded with their expensive and hard-to-replenish American air defense systems. Ukrainian interception drones offered an alternative. If your adversary can produce cheap technology to attack you, there comes a point where you cannot sustain the use of expensive technology to defend yourself, and that is true for even the wealthiest countries, says Alina Bilosova, strategic project advisor at the Kyiv School of Economics Institutes. So the Iran war became a kind of demonstration project, she adds, an opportunity for Ukraine to show these countries under attack a better and cheaper solution, and for other countries around the world to take note. At the same time, the world has witnessed that Ukraine's drone interception systems are not fail-safe. In early May, Russia launched one of its largest drone and missile barrages of the war, sending more than 1,500 drones and 50 missiles into Ukrainian cities, primarily Kyiv. At least 12 people were killed in Kyiv. Ukrainian officials reported that more than 90% of the drones were intercepted, but about one of every four missiles got through, prompting Mr. Zelensky to acknowledge that the country's air defense systems still require improvement. Deals and partnerships. Still, Ukraine's high interception figures have not gone unnoticed, prompting countries to seek a drone deal with Ukraine. In late March, Ukraine signed security partnerships with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and last month reached defense and drone deals with Germany, Norway, and the Netherlands. In May, Mr. Zelensky visited Bahrain, carrying a drone defense deal and security partnership proposal in his portfolio. Then Ukraine and Germany reached an agreement to jointly develop long-range drones that could reach nearly 1,000 miles. Even the U.S. is in early negotiations with Ukraine on a bilateral defense agreement that would open the door both to obtaining Ukrainian defense technologies and to joint ventures with United States defense companies for drone development and manufacturing. Interest in Ukraine's drone technology is also rising in regions well outside the European and Middle East war theaters. In April, Mr. Zelensky held a phone call with Chile's new president, José Antonio Kast, in which the two leaders discussed the role Ukrainian drones could play in surveillance of Chile's long, remote, and often unguarded international borders. Broader cooperation. Moreover, Ukraine has reasons to develop relations in the Middle East that go beyond weapon sales. When Zelensky went to Damascus, many people noticed that here was Ukraine and Syria, a country that has been very important for Russia's Middle East relations, says the Penn Center's Mr. Fisenko. Mr. Zelensky discussed not just defense matters with Syrian President Ahmed al-Shara, but also energy, food security, and regional cooperation. Indeed, the test for Ukraine now will be its ability to transform itself from a circumstantial darling of drone technology cooperation to a long-term partner, bringing a variety of interests to the diplomatic table, some experts say. The episodic visits by Zelensky to a few important countries is not going to be enough, says Mr. Fisenko. We really need an institutionalization of our diplomatic outreach that will allow us to build partnerships with more countries and the more areas of interest. Still, drone technology is likely to remain at the core of Ukraine's diplomacy for some time to come. Noting that it was only 6 months ago that Ukraine's parliament voted to allow some limited exemptions to a ban on arms exports, Ms. Celeste says Ukraine needs to pursue all the advantages its drone expertise has provided. We did not ask for this war, but it has allowed us to find our niche and to offer something that has many countries saying, we want Ukraine on our side, she says. Now we need to develop our drone diplomacy, and for that we need to scale up our export sales to have the money to continue driving the innovation that makes us a valued partner. Your Christian Science Monitor news for Monday, June 8, 2026, continues with this following article. Worst-case future climate scenarios set aside. International scientists decided it is no longer useful to study the most extreme model of runaway global warming. So why are some people upset? And this article is written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Story Hinckley. For the past 15 years, scientists have studied a climate doomsday. Under this worst-case scenario referred to in the scientific world as RCP 8.5, humans continue to burn fossil fuels with abandon through the 21st century, and the world heats up by almost 5 degrees Celsius, or 9 degrees Fahrenheit, above pre-industrial levels. On a dystopian RCP 8.5 Earth, Florida's coastline disappears underwater. Sub-Saharan Africa witnesses more than 85 million climate migrants by 2050, and half of the world's plant and animal species go extinct. It's a grim forecast. It's also, scientists recently announced, now an implausible one. In April, leading scientists for the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, announced that this particular scenario, one of four representative concentration pathways that measure the amount of solar energy trapped in the Earth's atmosphere under different levels of greenhouse gas emissions, is no longer a reasonable prediction, thanks to the growth of renewable energy and climate policies. Some have cheered the news, even as scientists in the same report said that the lower-end emission scenario of RCP 2.6, which aligns with the goal of limiting future warming below 2 degrees Celsius, may now be unrealistic as well. Others in the scientific community have rolled their eyes at this announcement of RCP's 8.5's retirement, arguing that RCP 8.5 has been improbable for several years now. Some even assert that this scenario was never indicative of any possible future, but was disingenuously propped up by climate activists who benefited from the grim attention it brought. But almost everyone agrees on a fundamental issue. It's challenging to communicate the complexity and nuance of science to politicians, activists, and the media, especially a science so complicated and politically charged as climate change research. after RCP 8.5 was created. Through a game of telephone, people started calling it the business-as-usual scenario, says Zeke Hausfather, a climate scientist who co-authored a 2020 paper arguing that RCP 8.5 was being incorrectly interpreted as our default future without stringent climate mitigation. It's futile to have worst-case scenarios. The problem for a while is that people were conflating the worst case with the most likely outcome. Two things can be true. Back when this model was published in 2011, the line chart of greenhouse gas emissions seemed to be rocketing to the sky with a 30% increase over the previous decade. But even then, RCP 8.5 set out to show a high-end scenario that relied on unprecedented five-fold increase in coal use by 2100. Today, we live in a different world that uses far less coal, says Dr. Hausfather. So what started as an unlikely worst-case scenario that has become outside of any likely realm of possibility, now as renewable energy usage accelerates. Two things can be true, he adds. The RCP 8.5 scenario was never intended to be the most likely outcome, and we also have made progress in making high-end scenarios less likely because of falling costs of clean energy, increasing global investments in clean energy, and moving away from fossil fuels. Some climate scientists say that the thousands of scientific studies assess the RCP 8.5 scenario were not only a waste of time and resources, but also distracted researchers from digging into more moderate scenarios that would be more relevant today. RCP 8.5 was merely a way to test the model to see what happened when it was pushed really hard, agrees Stephen Koonin, who serves as Undersecretary for Science Department of Energy in the Obama administration between 2009 and 2011. Kuiko Toro with the Anthropocene Institute compared the role of RCP 8.5 to an engineer simulating what would happen if 250 Army tanks drove onto a bridge at the same time. That's not going to happen, but it's a useful exercise for the engineer to learn about structural weakness. Dr. Koonin says some activists, journalists, and even scientists ran with this scenario to scare the public into reducing emissions, and some destroyed the reputations of scientists who dared to say, wait a minute. Not everyone agrees with that point of view, though. Chris Field, a climate scientist at Stanford University who co-chaired an IPCC working group between 2008 and 2015, refutes any claims that the scientific community deliberately tried to mislead people or encourage climate action by talking about RCP 8.5. He credits simulations from this high emissions scenario as inspiring the world to help avoid such an outcome. We wanted to understand a wide range, says Dr. Field. It's important to recognize that no one in the climate community, certainly not the climate modelers or economists, know what the future trajectory of emissions will be. Lessons from 8.5. Climate science is complicated. Not only are Earth's energy systems complex and intertwined, but they are affected by human behavior. And that, climate scientists say, is incredibly hard to calculate or predict, even if models did not have to consider unknown future societal motivations or policy priorities. But under current emissions trends, the planet looks to be following RCP 4.5. One of the two middle scenarios expected to bring an average global temperature increase about 3 degrees Celsius. That is still a very bad outcome, says Dr. Hausfather. Every additional bit of warming increases the risk of negative outcomes, he and other climate scientists point out. At just a 2 degrees Celsius increase, studies suggest that there is a greater likelihood of ecological damage, such as ocean coral reef collapse. Some studies also suggest that as many as 1 in 4 plant and animal species in the Amazon rainforest and Galapagos Islands could face local extinction. Extreme heat could also impact millions more people and challenge food systems across the world. And even the RCP 4.5 future assumes that the world continues on the same trajectory of burning less coal and flattening and later reducing fossil fuel consumption. The retirement of RCP 8.5, much more extreme scenario, is no reason to backtrack on clean energy progress, says many climate scientists, even as coal proponents such as President Donald Trump celebrate the news as evidence that climate concerns are overblown. You have to provide positive pathways. The real lesson from RCP 8.5 for the next climate model may lie in how it's communicated to the public, while balancing urgency with accuracy. Those activists who conflated the worst-case scenario with the most likely one may have had the opposite of the intended effect, say some scientists. RCP 8.5 was such a scary scenario, requiring so much change of unknown character, that people kind of just threw up their arms and said, "I'll leave it to the next generation," says Hadi Dolatabadi, who co-authored a 2017 paper questioning if the world even had the coal reserves needed to power an RCP 8.5 planet. You have to provide positive pathways for the public rather than scare the bejesus out of them. Next, it's the reader's turn to voice their opinion in the Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, June 8, 2026, with letters to the editor. This one's entitled "Something to Chew On." Where inflation is felt the most, the checkout counter, an article in the May 11 Weekly was interesting, but left me with a lot of questions. I'm the person in our family who purchases all the groceries and prepares most of the food. None of what was reported in this article was illuminating. I want to know what portion of the inflationary food prices reflects increased, unavoidable cost, and what portion is due to price gouging or tariffs. I want to know if there are alternatives to conventional grocery stores that can offer a better food supply model, such as farmers markets or bulk buying clubs. We're spending about $1,000 per month on food for two adults. We're on a fixed income. We eat very simply and modestly. We don't eat out. We cook a lot from scratch. I've saved paper and digital coupons. I comparison shop. It takes a lot of time. I'd like to hear from other people about how they're coping with these crazy prices. It seems that there must be many stressed out moms, grandmas, and aunties trying to make ends meet. Shopping used to be a chore. Now it's scary. Prices jump a dollar in a week, and you're left kicking yourself that you didn't stock up last week. Are we consumers ever going to get paid back for the illegal tariffs whose costs we've borne? And this letter is signed by Lauren Davis of Sisters, Oregon. Next in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, June 8, 2026, are numbers in the news. The number, 52%. The share of American men ages 18 to 49 who reported that they have an active sports betting account, according to a report by the Siena Research Institute in New York. Some 27% of Americans overall also report having an account. Respondents expressed concern with the online sports betting industry in the United States, with 74% calling participation of individuals as young as 18 years old a very or somewhat serious issue. And you have just heard the Christian Science Monitor News for Monday, June 8, 2026. I'm Mark Stangle for Mind's Eye, translating vision into audio. Thank you for listening, and have a great week.